advertisers or affiliates.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and, the views of our guests this evening and for the first hour. The views are those of Ron Brown, who supports Radio Liberty, and we certainly support him. And Ron deals with financial matters. And we've asked him to come on this evening to begin talking about some of the things that are happening. Certainly we are living, I believe, on the verge of a financial collapse of the world monetary system. And we only need to have read very carefully what Ben Bernanke, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, said to Congress, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, where he was talking about what's happening to the economy, guardedly optimistic, assuring everybody that the inflation rate, well, that is the core inflation rate, was really only 2%, and that if you took into account energy and food, it was about 4.4%, which was a little bit high, but he's sure it's going to be all right. And Mr. Bernanke is not telling the truth. The inflation rate is closer to 11%, and certainly Bob Chapman, but a number of other observers who are watching what's going on have come to about the same conclusion. And then when you take into account the credit and other commercial paper that is being created, we're talking 13-14%. And you have to understand that that is the real inflation rate. Inflation is not rising prices. Inflation is increasing the amount of money and credit that's out there, and it is because you increase the amount of money and credit that the prices tend to go up. And if you honestly believe that we have a 4% inflation, see what's happening at the food market. See what's happening at the gas station, and understand that figures don't lie, but liars can sure figure. And the last thing they want is for the American people to realize how much inflation there is, how many people are out of work, what they are of the implications of the imploding housing market. And, well, Ron, you pick up the story from there. How are you tonight?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Good to be on with you again.
Well, why don't you give us your impression of what's going on? And Mr. Bernanke's remarks, really, which were intent upon making everybody feel secure and feel that the Fed is doing what it's supposed to, and that is giving us a stable currency with no inflation, full employment, and certainly full production.
I think you started out right by saying inflation is probably the most understood, misunderstood concept in finance. The world has been conditioned to think, as you said earlier, that inflation is higher prices, when in reality it's nothing more than the increase in the money supply and credit. And you know, if you don't understand the very basics of inflation, then it's hard to make rational decisions. The example I give is if I was your college professor and I told you to go home and do a 500-page dissertation on rain, but start with the assumption that wet streets cause it, then you would never come to a valid conclusion, would you?
Sure.
By the same token, if you start with the idea that inflation is higher prices, then you'll never really understand what caused it. They can blame it on the labor unions. They can blame it on the Arab, nations. They can blame it on anything they want to, point the finger to someone else as the cause of it, when in reality the only people that can cause it is the people that control the money and create the money.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Ron, you go right ahead, because Ron was simply at the very crux of what this whole issue is. The people who can increase the money supply are the people who create inflation. And the people who increase the money supply is the Federal Reserve System. But, of course, they don't want you to know that. They want you to think that these things happen by themselves, and they do not. And, of course, recently, as of, I think, March of this year, they stopped providing something known as M3. M3 is the total of all the various money supplies and the amount of money created by the Federal Reserve System. And that's increasing at a rate of about 11 or 12% a year. And they're concealing that. They're saying, oh, shucks, it's too expensive. It's too hard. Well, they've always published the M3 ever since I can remember, up until recently. And they're not publishing it because they don't want the public to realize that the Federal Reserve System is intent upon destroying the foundation of our monetary system and is trying to print as much money as rapidly and to create as much money and credit as they can to keep this whole house of cards from collapsing. Go ahead, pick up there, Ron.
You know, you're always saying that the illusion is king, and that's what people believe. And I really think we are set up for a massive crisis based on one idea. And that is, over the last 20 years, we've been living through an illusion that the economy was strong and that there was no inflation. But in reality, while interest rates were coming down from 16% in 1982 to as low as, 4% or so on bonds, we had the most massive inflation in the history of this country. It's been unbelievable, the inflation of the money supply that we've had, yet somehow that has been camouflaged, because normally when you have inflation, that would force interest rates up. Yet this time around, for the last 20 years, we've been living through this false prosperity where we had massive inflation and yet interest rates were coming down. And I can attribute that to the simple fact that the rest of the world, it was totally dependent on trading with the United States. We're the biggest consumers of the world. And for 20 years, we had all the central banks of the world orchestrating their currencies lower versus the dollar. And the way they would do that is simply by selling Japanese bonds or other foreign bonds into the market, using the proceeds to turn around and buy U.S. Treasury bonds, strengthening the dollar. And so as we were running...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ron is simply talking about how the whole world monetary system has been manipulated, how countries throughout the world, since no country is on the gold standard, other countries throughout the world suddenly wanted to keep their currencies low, so that their products would be cheaper throughout the world and they could produce more and sell more, so they would artificially keep their currencies low. And, of course, each country then looking after its own inherent interests, keeping the value of the dollar high. And, of course, when the dollar is high, we can buy a lot more goods all throughout the world. And so we're getting all these goods in, and we're giving them the worthless paper dollars, and the thing has worked. It's worked like a charm. We have lived better, and it's at a much higher living standard than any other country in the history of mankind. You know, but, of course, this whole thing, this whole scam, I fear, is coming to an end, and I think it's coming to the end in the very, very near future. And it's time the American people understood that, as Voltaire said, eventually all paper money eventually returns to its true value, which is zero. And that's the story. It's a con game. The con game is just about up. And when this house of cards comes tumbling down, you don't want to be inside there or you're going to get hit by the flying bricks. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and the reason I think you're absolutely right that we're getting close to the end game, you see, for those 20 years, when interest rates were coming down, the foreigners who were buying our treasury bonds and financing our folly were happy as larks, because when interest rates go down, the value of bonds goes up. So you can imagine the foreigners who bought our treasury bonds when they were paying 15 or 16%, and interest rates go all the way down to 4%, they're making hundreds of percent on their investment, plus the fact that they exchanged yen, for example, for U.S. dollars, and the dollar during that period was real strong against the yen, so they were making money on the exchange rate, plus they were locking in a high interest rate on their investment. So they were winning all three ways. You know, it was a win-win-win situation, and that lasted until, guess what? Eventually, interest rates had to hit a point where they just couldn't go any lower. And that's what happened 2 or 3 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And since then, the dollar is down 35%, so whoever's holding, foreigners holding dollars are losing on the exchange rate. Secondly, interest rates are going up, so now the bond values are going down. So the people that own these massive amounts of bonds, and as we discussed last week or last time I was on, foreigners now own somewhere around 50% of our debt. So if you're holding, if you're a foreigner holding U.S. paper and interest rates are going up, then the value of those investments is going down. So it's a lose-lose-lose situation now. And all these people who've been accumulating these bonds over 20 years are saying enough is enough. We can't do it anymore. And that means our party is over, because now our creditors are starting to cut us off and that'll happen to anyone that abuses their credit. And of course, we had such an easy go for the last 20 years. We've been spending way beyond our means, but not to worry, foreigners were ready to finance it. But finally, they're saying enough is enough. So I think that's why we're getting very close to the end, because when they cut off your credit, and our whole thing is based, our whole financial system is based on the bond market, since it is the foundation of the whole monetary system, once your credit is cut off, then the party's over.
And I think it's important that people really understand what's been going on. And certainly, we, of course, initially created an artificial prosperity of the United States by running up the stock market artificially. How did they run it up artificially? Why, of course, they have something called the Plunge Protection Team, which is made of the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Board and some of the large banks. And they would interfere in the market and run the market up with no real basis in fact or reason for it. And then, of course, we not only had the Dow Jones, we had the NASDAQ. And the NASDAQ got up to 5,000, and basically had stocks that were selling at 200 times price-earnings ratio, when the price-earnings ratio should be 10, maybe 12 at the most, 14, but they were selling it 200 times. It was all artificial, all speculation, and all you had to do was invest and make money hand over fist. And then, of course, the stock market and the NASDAQ market collapsed. And so what did they do? Then they began creating the housing bubble. And they actively encouraged people to buy homes they couldn't afford. And, of course, they gave them adjustable-rate mortgages, nothing down, no interest on your home. And you just sign right here on the dotted line. And then, of course, they would take these mortgages and they'd put them into bundles. They called them CDO or collateralized debt obligations. And then, of course, they would have this. They would create a bond out of that. And then, of course, other people would buy that. And then, of course, we had something called the hedge funds. Now, certainly during the Great Depression in 1929, a lot of people lost their shirts because they were on margin. And you could buy stock 10% down, and as long as the stock was going up, you were making 10 times your initial investment plus whatever was happening to that stock. And fortunes were made overnight. But when the market turned against you, you could be wiped out in just a few days because you were on margin. In other words, you had nothing behind your investment. Well, they've kept the margin rates down to about 50%. You can't buy stocks without at least being able to put up 50%. But they found a way around that. It's called the hedge funds. And the hedge funds were means of doing exactly what had happened in the 1920s. And that was, of course, buying either options or stocks or all sorts of credit obligations. But leveraging this, so a hedge fund would be people, pension funds, people with a lot of money. And, of course, unregulated, they could take have $100 million, and they could go out and borrow $1 billion on that $100 million and then invest that. And as long as everything is going up, you're in great shape. And, of course, people have been saying, but we should regulate the hedge funds, because when you have all of this accumulation of debt and no regulation, if something ever happens and the hedge funds all begin to collapse at one time, you could bring the whole economy of our country down. And Alan Greenspan and the central bankers who control our economy discourage the idea of regulating the hedge funds. And at the time, it didn't seem right. Why were they discouraging the regulation of the hedge funds? Why were they encouraging unsound financial measures as far as the housing was concerned? It created a great housing bubble, but of course, when the housing bubble began to deflate, while we find more and more people face losing their homes, but not only that, but the people who invested in those mortgages that resulted from the unsound financial mechanisms, these hedge funds heavily leveraged are beginning to collapse. Bear Stearns lost somewhere $6 billion in the last few weeks, and of course that hedge fund is just going right under. But this could begin to take down our banking institutions. What do you think about that, Ron?
I think the key to understanding that, because if you go through the logic of what you were saying, it doesn't make a bit of sense to allow such insanity to go on in the financial markets. So you can either look at it as a bunch of morons running the asylum, or they have an agenda. But part of it is that they simply, when we created this monetary system, we really created the Ponzi scheme, because the whole monetary system is simply based on debt. And so once the debt level gets to a certain level, you must keep it growing. You can never allow a recession to take over, because then everyone would start to default on their debts, and the whole system would collapse overnight in a 29-style banking panic. So they'll do everything they can to keep the bubble propped up. And, of course, one way they did it, which tied into my earlier analogy, is the Japanese lowered their interest rates down to like 1% or 0.5%. So then the Japanese or the yen carry trade started to develop, where these big hedge funds would borrow, let's say, $100 million to go along with your example, in Japanese yen. They would pay them 0.5%. They would turn around, leverage that tenfold, and buy U.S. Treasury bonds paying 5 or 6%. That created, allowed the bubble to keep going, because we were financing our deficits with all these bond purchases with leveraged money. But see, whenever you leverage, at some point, the leverage will work against you when it turns down. And I really think that's the point we've reached. The interest rates cannot go any lower. The foreigners that have been financing our folly for 20 years are finally saying we can't do it or we won't do it. And so as the foreigners back off and refuse to finance our debt, that even puts a tighter squeeze on things. So that's why they got to keep these hedge funds going and the high leverage to keep the bubble going, yet we're getting at the very, we're just really near a climax in this whole thing. And when it happens, it's going to happen so fast that that average person is going to say, what happened? You know, they don't understand. Because things have been so artificially brilliant for the last 15, 20 years that people can't see that there's any danger ahead.
And of course, the thing is, who's going to get hurt from this is not the people who understand what's happening. It is the unsophisticated individual, the guy who's been working hard all of his life to prepare for retirement. He's got a pension fund. He's got money invested in CDs. He's got money invested in the bank. He's got money invested in annuities. And of course, he's just waiting to the point where he can retire and live comfortable on all that money. But the difficulty is the money is denominated in dollars. The dollar's lost 30% of its value in the last 2 years, and just the last day or so, it's been to get down around 80 to a basket. The currency was 120, and now it's down to 80. And there's just sophisticated people think it's going to lose another 35, maybe even 50% of its value. And, of course, when that happens, white people have lost the vast majority of the value of everything they count on. Well, Ron, certainly the dollar doesn't look like it's doing too well these days. Where did it end up today? Do you have any idea?
Well, it was down most of the days, and they apparently, the plunge protection team.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
For whatever anguish it may give me, please tell me the truth so I can best prepare for it. And to blindly, accept the lies, you're just setting yourself up for a major fall. You know, I've always said, Dr. Stan, that if you lived in an honest society where you had an honest monetary system, all a person had to do was be the best at whatever he does. If he's a farmer, just be the best farmer you can. If you're a plumber, you know, if you're an electrician, whatever you are, do a good job at that. Make your living and take 5 or 10% of that, put it away, and to prepare for your retirement, and everyone could be, you know, in good shape when they were ready to retire. But when you live in a bogus system like we have today where they're destroying the value of the money, then everyone, regardless of what they do for a living, has to become some sort of an economist in order to survive. Because if you don't understand the things that are at play in the economy, then you can't prepare for it. And I think one of the greatest illusions now that most Americans in particular are suffering with is that we've lived in a society where the monetary system was relatively stable. You know, we might have been having 2 to 3% inflation, which will eat you alive, but it's not something that destroys a society overnight. So most people think in terms of nominal return on their money. So if they made a 10% return on their money this past year, they'd say, I did okay, you know. And, of course, you have to pay taxes on that 10%. But then when you wake up to the reality that inflation was running at 11%, you're falling behind the treadmill. The treadmill's going faster than you are. You know, there's all this hype that's been coming out the last few weeks about the stock market is now at all-time highs of, what, 14,000, I think?
Right,
a little 14,000 a day. And so you say that's prosperity. Well, the stock market hit almost 12,000 back in year 2000 before the dot-com bubble popped. So the market's been up, let's say, 18% in the last 7 years, which right off the bat's not very, very good. But when you filter out the cost of living and realize that the dollar is down 30 to 35% against all the currencies in the world, in reality, the people are falling way behind at a faster and faster clip. And if we go into the type of hyperinflation that I think we're heading for over the next year to 2 years, then people could lose their wealth in just a matter of a year or two.
In fact, if Bob Chapman is right, and I think he probably is, and we're talking about 14 or 15% inflation within a year and a half. You know, in 3 years, you've lost almost half the value of your currency. And, of course, this is happening at a phenomenal clip. And the average American doesn't think in those terms. He thinks of a dollar being worth a dollar, but see what a dollar will buy today compared to what it would buy 5 years ago. And you find that we're losing the value of our currency at a very rapid clip. And the average individual has no idea because he still thinks the dollar is worth a dollar. And it's not. The value has to do with what something will buy and not the fact that it's what's printed there on the dollar bill. So I think it's important that people begin to understand what's happening, begin to realize that we're in a totally fiat money system, and the history of fiat money systems is they always collapse. Certainly Thomas Jefferson knew that. It was Daniel Webster who said, I mean, certainly there is no greater way to deceive or steal from the working class than through the process of paper money. And that's exactly what we've got today. But, of course, there's lots of other things that are happening. Certainly the jobs continue disappearing. We are intentionally sending our factories and sending our jobs overseas. They tell us about all the new good-paying jobs, and yet General Motors is asking for a 40% reduction in pay scales here. Delphi, which supplies various things that go into cars, car parts, Delphi has worked out a deal with the union where they've taken a 50% reduction in income. A 50% reduction in their income, you know, and of course that includes their health benefits, their pension funds, and their monthly salary. How would you like to take a 50% cut in your income and you were glad to have the job? Because if you knew if you didn't take it, why you wouldn't have any job at all. And this is what many of our workers are actually facing today. Now, it may be the work you are, you don't have to worry about that, but Believe me, there are a lot of people who do. Give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question or for Ron. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. You know, at one time there was a statement that was that what's good for General Motors is good for America. Well, General Motors now, as a corporation, has a net worth of about $50 billion, a net worth of $50 billion, I should say, negative $50 billion. In other words, they're $50 billion in debt. A Ford Motor Company has hawked everything to raise funds just to keep on operating. And as you know recently, Dahmer has actually sold Chrysler to another hedge company or hedge fund, which thinks that they'll be able to operate at a profit. We're just going to have to wait and see what's happening. The Japanese automotive companies are doing good. The American motor companies are doing terribly, at least here in the United States, where they're actually having to sell their cars at cost just to keep the production lines open because they have contracts with the unions that require them to keep the production lines open or pay their employees for not working. So they're producing cars, they're selling them at cost, and that's one reason why the cost of American cars is not going up and creating inflation. So, Ron, where is our automotive industry headed today?
Well, you know, I would say that our corporations have been forced or have been doing it voluntarily, but they've been moving everything overseas, and I think it's part of it is designed to take care of, advantage of the slave labor over there, but it's also probably designed to break the back of the labor union, just as you mentioned. If you either take a big cut or lose the job to overseas, then people are desperate for the jobs, and they will accept these cuts that they wouldn't have accepted 20 years ago, for sure, if you remember all the labor union strikes and everything, pushing for higher wages. And now in a time of unbelievable inflation, they're willing to take a pay cut, so they're losing both ways. But, you know, just take that GM situation and put it into the equation. You're talking about a $50 billion net worth. How many billions of dollars of bonds do they have out there? And here's a company that's going under. Are they going to be able to pay off their bonds, or even keep paying the interest on their bonds? And then you ask the question, how many GM workers have a pension plan that's invested a lot in these GM bonds and these other paper assets? They're in great jeopardy. So
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And before we go on, Ron, I'd like you to get your telephone number out in case people would like to get in touch with you and talk to you about about what's going on, get your thoughts on how you might be able to help them. So what is your telephone number, and how can people reach you?
They can reach me at 1-800-595-0561. That's 1-800-595-0561.
All right. Now, because Ron was just saying, basically, General Motors has a net worth of about $50 billion, and Ford Motor Company isn't too far behind that. And so they've got all these bonds out there, of course, is the basis there. So they've been borrowing this money just to keep running. But a lot of our pension funds are invested in those bonds. A lot of our pension funds are invested in, certainly, in hedge funds. A lot of our pension money is invested in junk bonds. And junk bonds, during the good times, have been paying 1 or 2% higher than AAA rated bonds. And it's been a great source of income for people who are investing. But what happens when the people who've issued those junk bonds begin reneging on them? Are we seeing any instances where people are actually refusing to pay on their bonds, refusing to redeem their bonds, Ron?
Well, I think the immediate example I come to is this latest thing with Bear Stearns. See, those were in effect treated as bonds. They were sold into the market as bonds, and now these subprime mortgages are defaulting at record rates, and people are trying to get out of those investments, and the market won't. The market prices collapsed on them. Now, Bear Stearns came out and tried to bail it out temporarily, but all they did was put a little patch on it, and it's not going to stop it. It may put off the day of reckoning another week or two or another month, but now it's starting to spill over into the Merrill Lynch's and all these big Wall Street firms who now it's coming to the surface. They got literally billions of dollars of these hedge funds and these derivatives that are invested in these worthless or soon to be worthless bonds. So it's the whole thing is starting to unravel.
And of course, we saw an example here a couple of years ago where one of the largest and oldest banks in the world, and I think it was at Barclays, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the largest and oldest and most prosperous banks in the world went under in a matter of about 2 weeks because one of the people who was managing their funds had bet very, very heavily in the options market, and it turned against them. He was certainly heavily leveraged and simply wiped out the entire value of all the money they held by that bank literally overnight, and the bank collapsed, and that was the end of it, and everybody was invested in that bank, lost everything they had.
I think that was Barron's Bank.
It was a Barron's Bank, okay.
Yeah, see, they've kept this house of cards going for the last 20-something years with all these manipulations and creative financing. And to the average person out there who doesn't study economics and they listen to their Wall Street broker who is just, most of them are just selling what their boss has told them to sell that morning, and people don't realize how risky some of this stuff that they're buying is. You know, for example, with this Bear Stearns thing, there's all sorts of pension plans and institutions out there who have strict guidelines, strict rules, that they can only invest in something with AAA rating. Well, all of a sudden, these CDOs that you were talking about, all you've really done is take a subprime lender, which is a very high-risk loan. You know, people that bought a variable rate mortgage with interest-only loan and no money down, that's not what I call a lot of safety in that loan. And yet they've taken these high-risk loans, said a few magic words, hocus-pocus, and they've converted them into AAA rating, and these pension plans have bought these, and now they're starting to get stung. And just last week, Moody's and Standard & Poor's was forced to come out and downgrade some of these, you know, billions of dollars of these securities, which now in turn, if things don't change, if they don't come up with another rabbit, will force a lot of these pension plans and institutions to sell those bonds because suddenly they've lost that rating. So you could create a mass selling exodus in a lot of this risky paper. And this is paper that was deemed very safe just 6 months ago.
And of course, the thing is that they bought these bonds at 100 cents value on the dollar. They were AAA bonds. Well, of course, they never should have been rated AAA. And they should have been considered junk bonds or below. And so, these were not only bought, but they were bought with leveraged money. In other words, massive leveraging, perhaps a 10 to 1, 20 to 1, 30 to 1, and suddenly now they find that these bonds that they bought, thinking they were worth 100 cents on the dollar, are worth 30 cents on the dollar. And all of the funds in that hedge fund are suddenly gone. They simply disappeared. That's what happened to Bear Stearns. They put in $3.5 billion, and they kept the hedge fund going about 2 weeks, and they had to shut it down, and all of the money that they had, I think about $6 billion, is simply gone. And what we're beginning to see is a massive liquidation of debt. And since our whole monetary system is built upon debt, and as the debt begins to disappear, then liquidity begins to disappear, and it becomes increasingly difficult to borrow money. You want to go out and borrow money for a business, you can't get it. And, of course, down the line, as this continues, and inflation begins to roar, the only thing you could do is inflation takes off, as it already has, is sooner or later you're going to have to begin to raise the prime interest rate from 5.25% up to as high as they did back in 1979, 1980, where the interest rate went up to 21%. And as a result, you could not borrow money to do anything with, and they had to do that to preserve the monetary system. Will they have the courage to do that again? Or are we going the same way as Rhodesia, where today their inflation rate is 4,000% a year? Our telephone number, 1-800-1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I just have one question. I'm wondering how much of the stock market activity is due to drug traffickers. And the reason I'm asking is because I understand the stock market is a highly favored place to launder dirty money such as that, because people can bring very large sums of money and spend them there, no questions asked. Whereas if they took their money to the bank, then, you know, they're going to have a little trouble, but not so with the stock market.
All right, Rod, do you know anything at all about that?
No, I really don't have any insight on that. I'm sure it is going on, but it's just a sign of the times where there's so much paper money sloshing around the globe. It there's all sorts of creative things to, you know, to keep this bubble going. I don't know what else to add to that. I'm sure there's a lot of it going on, but I would have no idea how much.
Well, that's why it's a great money laundering place. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Mike. Again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And what people don't understand is the world is awash in money. Now, you're not. But certainly the sophisticated investors have all this artificial money that's been created. And what is behind the money? Absolutely nothing. There's no gold behind it. It is based upon absolutely nothing. And sooner or later, of course, this whole thing begins to implode. And, of course, because all that money is highly inflationary, and so that you hear about this, this major corporation that's going to buy another major corporation for $40 billion. Where's that money coming from? And, of course, it's coming from all this liquidity that's out there, but as things begin increasingly uncertain, people are not going to want to lend the money to buy that $40 billion corporation. And down the line, of course, people begin to get more and more careful as far as lending is concerned. And when you get to the point where, of course, you can't borrow money, then you got to begin to raise the interest rates. You got to raise the interest rates to be able to get people to lend money, and specifically to get them to lend money to our government so that we can continue operating. Because right today, the United States is having to borrow between $2 and $3 billion every day just to meet our obligations. At one time, we were the greatest creditor nation in the world. Today, we're the largest debtor nation in the world, and what most people don't understand is that Russia has far more in the way of reserves than the United States. And yet, of course, the Bush administration continues funding money and giving money to the Russians, which really doesn't make sense unless there is another agenda out there. Well, our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And Ron, what's happening to the gold and silver market? Because I know that's what you watch very, very closely.
Yeah, we're, Dr. Stan, we're in the summer doldrums when the market is typically slow. Plus, if you'll recall, the gold and silver market peaked from a four-year rise. Gold went from like $250 to $730, and silver went from somewhere around the $4 level, got up over $15, and that was May the 8th or so, a year ago, in 2006. That forced the powers to be around the world, the central bankers all around the world, to come to the rescue of the dollar and try to prop it up to keep the system propped up. And one of the things they do, of course, is manipulate and suppress the price of gold and silver. So if you think about it, we've been in the correction phase of this bull market now going on 15 months, plus we're in the summer doldrums, and you know how investors are. What have you done for me lately? So if you were one of the many people that, that caught up and got excited about gold and silver after it made that massive run up to $15 on silver and $700 on gold, and bought here a year and a half or a year and 3 months later, you're still at a loss. So the market has not been exuberant. You know, it's, people are a little downtrodden, but we're about to end this correction phase. We're about to end the summer doldrums, and we're going into the phase of the market when things start to, when gold and silver normally would start to rise again. And I think it's happening at the very time when all of these hedge funds are starting to fall apart, and you see more and more countries saying we're not going to accept dollars and we're only going to accept euros or whatever. And as the world repudiates and branches away from the dollar, that's going to put a lot more money coming into gold and silver. So we're going to reach a point, and I think it's when you go into the next leg up is when things start to happen very, very quickly, because you look at all the manipulation scams that they've used to hold it down, and when those are finally exposed, then you're going to see a knee-jerk reaction and an explosion to the upside. And I really believe that's where we are in the gold and silver market.
Well, I do, and Chris, the thing that really concerns me is that I believe that all of the evidence points to the fact that we're going into a war with Iran, and now we're having a hard time funding what we're doing as far as Iraq is concerned. Where is the money coming from a war with Iran? Because they tell us it's only going to last 6 days, you know, and after 6 days we'll have won the war and we can come home. But isn't that what they said about Iraq? You remember when George Bush landed on the carrier there and announced we've won the war in Iraq? You know, this was certainly there very early in 2003. But it wasn't true. And when you start a war, you never know where it's going to end.
Well, plus the very fact when you start this war, you're just going to exacerbate, one, our inflationary problem. You're going to accelerate the flight out of the dollars as our countries around the world lose confidence in it. Because there's a lot of people that have deals and contracts and treaties with Iran. So, you know, Russia and Venezuela and all these. But once you start going to war, then you're going to create more problems than you know what to do with. I just think they're trapped in a policy that is destined to send us into, total monetary crisis, because the world doesn't need to outbuild us and with war materials. All they have to do is cut off our source of money that allows us to create that wealth. So if they collapse our monetary system, that's going to do a lot to undermine our ability to keep the war machine going.
And we have an article written by the former assistant chief of the Soviet military who asked this very, very legitimate question: why is America considering going to war with Iran? And when you start a war, you never know how it's going to end. Would you use tactical nuclear weapons? What would be the implications of that? Why would America, of course, do something that is so illogical as going to war with Iran? Because they're not going to be able to develop nuclear weapons for several years yet. And even if they had a nuclear weapon, they would be foolish to actually use it on Israel or any other country because they know the terrible cost of reprisal. So why would they do that? And his explanation was because America has some very real economic problems. And all throughout the world there are all these dollars out there, and there are more dollars out there floating around the world than there is value in the American stock market and the American real estate market and all the value in America. And the best way, of course, to end this whole fiasco of all this liquidity and artificial liquidity out there would be to precipitate a crisis and then simply renounce your world debt, exactly as Argentina did recently and other countries have done in the past, and say we're just not going to pay our debt. And now that would leave, of course, other countries in the world holding literally trillions of dollars that would be unredeemable. It would just say, sorry, we have exchange controls. You can't, we will not redeem your money. You are just out of luck. Could this be what it's really all about? And if you'd like to see that article, we'd be glad to send it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. An article by the former assistant head of the Russian military. And certainly it is a logical explanation, I believe. Of course, there's even a more sinister purpose, and that is because I believe our leaders really have no loyalty to America. Their whole idea is to create a world government, and out of the chaos that's going to come from the unstable monetary system as it begins to implode, will become a cry for stability, and the American people will be able to, willing to give up their sovereignty as we move into a stable society, perhaps a new world currency backed by gold. Who knows what's going to happen? But we do know that the one we've had for such a long period of time has simply failed, and of course, most people, both foreign and domestic, are going to lose most of what they hold and what they own. Well, Ron, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I think we've covered an awful lot of ground tonight, and I hope people see that there is an unbelievable risk in maintaining your wealth in paper assets, the very currency that is in the process of being repudiated by the world. So people need to create a sense of urgency in their mind that they need to start checking out and learning some of this so that they can feel comfortable doing the only thing they can do to protect themselves. It's so obvious to me that we're in the end times, because when the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the leadership, elitist people that run this country, when they come out with a 70-page document explaining the North American community and the new currency and a step-by-step plan of how they plan to accomplish this, that should tell people that they're getting ready for the end game, that they're trying to prepare the American people to accept a solution that they wouldn't otherwise accept, and that is a destruction of our national sovereignty, and create a new currency and merge our nation in with two other countries. And at that point, we're no longer a constitutional republic. All the rights and privileges that we have taken for granted for all of our life will suddenly be gone, and people will wake up too late to realize we've lost that system of limited government that guarantees us our freedom and prosperity.
And you're speaking of that little book called Building a North American Community.
That's right.
And I think everybody should get it. We actually got a copy from the Council on Foreign Relations, but you can actually get a copy. They are available through the publisher. I go to Amazon.com, and to get it, it's well worthwhile reading, although I think they used to have it available for nothing on the CFR website. But the purpose of the Council on Foreign Relations is the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation. The people who lead this hate American sovereignty. They, of course, many of them have served for our government, having sworn to uphold our Constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and yet these are domestic enemies of our Constitution. They're globalists, and you have a right to be a globalist, but you do not have a right to swear to uphold the Constitution and then betray it. And we're talking about people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, we're talking about people like Henry Kissinger, and even though David Rockefeller has never promised to uphold our Constitution, he is one of the leaders of this whole movement, as the whole Rockefeller clan, but behind them are powerful spiritual forces. And until you recognize the spiritual forces that energize these people, nothing going on really makes sense today. Well, this is Dr. Stan Ron. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
And once more, let's get that telephone number out.
If you want to reach me, it's 1-800-595-0561. It's 1-800-595-0561. And please feel free to call me. I don't charge anything to talk with you. I love to, I try to think of myself more as an educator to try to wake people up to what's coming on, because I see great danger and great damage and hurt that's going to hit a lot of people that are going into this unprepared. You know, the scriptures say, my people perish for lack of knowledge. So give me a call. I'll try to inform you as best I can and get you on the right foot to understand what's happening with this monetary system.
All right, God bless, and thanks very much, Ron.
Okie dokie.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners of Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you'd like to understand basically what we've been talking about this evening, let me suggest, first of all, that you get the little pamphlet we've put together based upon five of our newsletters. It's called The History of Money. It's just a small pamphlet, maybe 30 pages. It's five newsletters and, of course, there are eight pages in each newsletter, seven pages, so figure 56 pages, something like that. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will want to get my talk on the financial tsunami. The financial tsunami, along with the syllabus, will give you the information, what the meaning is of M1, M2, M3, what derivatives are, what hedge funds are, what the carry trade is, all of these phrases which are used so glibly by people who talk about what's going on. And, of course, when we gave that talk, we were really foreseeing exactly what is happening today. As the hedge funds are beginning to collapse one at a time, as the carry trade is being decimated, as the derivatives are threatened to become what Warren Buffett has suggested they are, and that is financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent, but potentially lethal. So understand what is really happening today, the history of fiat money systems, and prepare yourself. And remember, there are three rules in investing, and I'm not a financial consultant, but I will tell you the three rules that the smart people know about. And it's diversify, diversify, diversify. Do not put all your eggs in a basket, because if anybody steps on the basket, the game is over. And then, of course, put the things into the context of what will happen if we go to war with Iran and the whole world turns against the American dollar and other countries stop accepting American dollars as payment for a debt. And other countries will no longer, of course, be required to use dollars for the purchase of oil. And, of course, then the dollar will return to its true value, the value of the paper. And the value of paper is just about nothing. So consider what's going on today, and then consider the spiritual implications of what is guiding America towards its destruction. Could God be about to bring his wrath upon our nation and upon the world? And remember what Thomas Jefferson wrote, God, who has given us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and our website, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back in just a moment with the next hour of Radio Liberty right here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guest, Andrew Christie, the views of our callers, and we welcome our callers from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But please don't call unless we ask for calls, because we have this on the line, Mr. William Grigg, who's formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, he writes for several other publications, and certainly he is certainly one of the most astute observers we have of what's going on, and this move away from freedom here at home. In fact, a move towards ever more government control and regulation of the individual. Because the American people have lost sight of the fact that freedom is not free. It is always lost whenever there's a centralization of power. Our founding fathers feared government, and they knew that the only way men could be free is if you were able to limit the power of government over their lives of the people. Because, as Sidney had been so well said, that government governs best that governs the least. That government governs best that that governs the least. And our founding fathers recognized that, and of course that's why they created the Constitution as they did, with limitations placed upon the power of government so they could take the chains off the people and put them on the government. Well, of course, we've come a long ways since then. William, please tell us what's on your heart, what you'd like to talk about tonight.
Well, thank you. I think one of the most important things that has been said in the political realm for the last several months, if not several years, was an observation made by George F. Will on last Sunday's installment of the ABC program This Week with George Stephanopoulos. George Will is a very establishmentarian conservative. He calls himself a Tory, which would put him in rather bad light to those who have some passing acquaintance with the history of our American War for Independence, because the Tories were the ones who supported the king. But in any case, George Will last week was talking about discussions that were ongoing at the time about the possibility of American withdrawal from Iraq and the political consequences. Not the consequences on the ground in Iraq necessarily, but the political consequences in Washington if this were to take place. And this is what George F. Will said, and I quote, "We are in danger of having a Weimar moment in our politics. German politics was embittered disastrously by the belief that they were on the cusp of victory in 1918 and were stabbed in the back by the civilian leadership that didn't understand Germany's military prowess. There is a constituency, this town," meaning Washington, D.C., "that believes we're winning in Iraq, that we have at last figured it out, and that the indices of success are there. And if we pull out and have the kind of disastrous consequences, telegenic disastrous consequences, or could have, we're going to have people saying we had it won and threw it away." Now, when George Will said a Weimar moment, what I think he meant to say was that the political tone in Washington, D.C. could become such that the stab in the back myth could take root and flourish among the neocons, which is to say the Trotskyite socialists who are running the Republican Party's top echelon leadership, and that they could cultivate in the minds of a significant portion of the public this idea that we would have won in Iraq if it hadn't been for the naysayers, the doubters, the people who ran down the president and so forth. In an essay I wrote a couple of years ago, I called this "Clap for Tinkerbell Patriotism," the idea that we mystically uphold the president's powers by supporting him unflinchingly, and that if we criticize the president somehow, we're going to diminish his powers to hold at bay the evildoers who would kill us all. And what George F. Will is talking about here is that that same kind of curdled, vengeful, vindictive attitude was something that was seen in Germany's political elite after they lost World War One, and it set the stage for something.
Well, let's hope we'll be right back. Go right ahead, Well,
yeah, it set the stage for something even nastier in Weimar Germany than Wilhelmine Imperial Germany had been, and that was the emergence of revolutionary socialism. You had in some of the states of Germany full-fledged communist-style Soviets that took root, and they were uprooted by the Freikorps, that is to say, by the so-called right-wing. Actually, there were different flavor of left-wing militarist groups that were part of the movement that coalesced into National Socialism. And when George Will talks about a Weimar moment in American politics, he's talking about something exponentially uglier than we've seen before, which would be a full-scale descent into authoritarian police state tyranny. And it's just amazing to me that somebody who's as normally sober and sanguine as George F. Will about politics would be speaking in terms of that sort, because I've seen the same trends over the last several years, and I've seen the same trends within the Republican Party, where there is this cult of the leader state that has taken root. And when somebody like George F. Will can say this on national television on a Sunday morning program, I think that we'd best be paying attention to what's going on and take a weather report, because I think we're in for some really heavy weather ahead.
Well, I certainly agree with you. In fact, everything seems to be in place for the establishment of a military dictatorship in America, and certainly we see that act after act and a piece of legislation after legislation allowing the military to be used against the American citizens, for the president to be unilaterally able to take charge of the National Guard without the permission of the state governors. But even more frightening were the pieces of legislation. Well, they weren't really legislation. They were authoritarian edicts. They were presidential directives. I think it was the 9th of May, of both the Homeland Security and the National Security directives, which gives the president the ability to establish a military dictatorship and martial law in America at any time he wants to. And where is the outcry from our conservative leaders? Where is the outcry from our elected representatives? Where, of course, is the outcry from our churches about this assumption of power that nowhere is authorized in the Constitution?
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the concept of a militarist dictatorship in our country and how the foundations have been laid for that, and the lineaments are pretty much visible right now. What George F. Will called the Weimar moment, I think, happened last October. I think it was October 17th when George W. Bush signed into law the revisions to the Insurrection Act, which provide for the president to take control of the National Guard, and the Military Commissions Act, which essentially abolished habeas corpus, which is something that was done in 1933 in Germany. And the Weimar Constitution,
Hold up right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is William Gregan. He was simply talking about George Will on a morning program with Stephanopoulos, had talked about, in Germany, a Weimar moment, where, of course, the people of Germany were beginning to say, well, we really didn't lose the First World War. It was simply because our leaders lost sight of the vision of winning. And, of course, it was this idea of a Weimar moment was the idea of moving towards an authoritarian Germany. And he was using that as an analogy for almost what is going on in America today. And I really believe, of course, as William does, that there is a very real chance of having a military dictatorship in the United States within the next 18 months or so. So go right ahead with the story there, William.
I was talking about the Weimar Constitution that was created after World War One, and it was considered to be the most progressive and sophisticated constitution of its type for what was called the Weimar Republic, which was the interregnum between Wilhelmine Germany in World War One and National Socialist Germany that took root in 1933. But the Weimar Republic's constitution had a fatal flaw, and that is that it had a provision that permitted the chief executive, the president, to rule by decree. And that was something that was used on several occasions by some of the very liberal governments of the Weimar Republic in the 1920s, dealing with such things as insurrections. And also it was used for gun confiscation, which I find quite provocative, and for dealing with the economic turmoil that was occasioned by the complete collapse of the Reichsmark, which was a result of the reparations that were enforced on Germany and how they had their the Tsar confiscated and a lot of their industrial and natural resources sectors were taken away from them as part of the war guilt clauses of the Versailles Treaty. But the thing is, that constitution permitted Hitler to do what he did when he was appointed chancellor in 1933. And so when I talk about my version, or my vision rather, perception of the Weimar moment in our political history, it would be in October of last year when we had the Military Commissions Act passed and signed by George W. Bush that abolished the habeas corpus and the revisions made to the Insurrection Act permitting the president to seize control of and nationalize the National Guard as his own Praetorian army. And then you mentioned also this past May, in the previous segment, Dr. Stan, you mentioned this past May the executive order that would set out the basic framework for an authoritarian, militarized executive dictatorship in the event of some kind of a natural catastrophe or terrorist attack. So really, the foundational building blocks, the Weimar-type state, are already in existence. We're just waiting some kind of a catastrophe that would bring about this development. And when you have people like Rick Santorum, the former Republican senator from Pennsylvania, talking about how within the next 18 months or so, public opinion about the wisdom of the Iraqi war is going to change because of horrible things that are going to happen in this country. And you hear the Department of Homeland Security Commissar Michael Chertoff talking about how we're likely to be hit by a terrorist attack. It's just his gut feeling that this would be so. And we see the National Intelligence Estimate come out just a few days ago saying that Al-Qaeda is just as strong as it was in 2001 right now, and that they're looking to attack the U.S. homeland. It seems to me that they're tuning the atmosphere for some kind of a precipitating event that would put these things in motion. And we have to be alert to that possibility, that a staged event or an exaggerated event or something that would be permitted to happen would occur and set into motion and activate all of these provisions that have been written into law over the last several years that would permit our country to descend into full-scale executive despotism. And it's, once again, very provocative to me that of all the people who would make that kind of an observation, not that specific observation, but an observation that's of the same kind, it would be George F. Will, who is the bow-tied professorial embodiment of Beltway conservatism. That, to me, is a really interesting development.
Well, I think that, of course, they're good people in the Council on Foreign Relations. Some of the people at the very, very top know exactly what this is all about. There are a lot of people in the Council on Foreign Relations who realize that this is a good way to get ahead. If
yeah.
you want, of course, have the major newspapers carry your articles, and you get invited to be on the radio on Sunday morning with George Stephanopoulos. You toe the line. You did not tell the truth. But I mean, I do not know what's in George Will's heart, but I will share your concern that, mm-hmm. that there is a very real movement towards a dictatorship in America. And what bothers me is there would be an awful lot of people who would say, well, you know, if a Christian president feels this is necessary to preserve our freedom, then we're just going to have to give up our freedom to preserve our freedom.
Yeah.
And, of course, where is the outcry with this idea that they're paying $385 million a year to Sidney Halliburton to be on standby so they would be immediately able to build a large number of concentration camps in America.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the outcry in America of the fact that the refurbishing of those concentration camps were used to house the Japanese during the Second World War? And, of course, they're even refurbishing many of the concentration camps that were used to house prisoners of war, from other countries during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And why isn't anybody commenting how putting all the dots together, and especially this directive as of the 9th of May of this year, obviously the leaders who really run this country intend a military dictatorship.
One thing I need to point out quickly is that George Stephanopoulos is a member of the CFR, but George Will has not been a member of the CFR since 1994. He was a member of the CFR between, if I remember correctly, 1978 and 1994, and it was while he was with the CFR that he won his Pulitzer Prize and also secured his very lucrative television contract, something on the order of $500,000 a year back when that was real money. to be on ABC exclusively as a commentator for This Week and also for World News Tonight at the time with Peter Jennings, that I think that George went off the reservation on a couple of issues about, let me think, about a year before he was, before he left the CFR, before his name was left off the CFR roster. He wrote a newspaper column exposing Presidential Decision Directive 21, which was a version of a Presidential Decision Directive, which later became Presidential Decision Directive 25, setting out the conditions under which U.S. Military personnel would serve under foreign military commanders as part of U.N. peacekeeping missions. George Will actually wrote a column about that. Now, that followed by a matter of months, similar publicity would give into that subject back when I was on the staff of the New American magazine. So he was somewhat behind the curve of the New American magazine, but the fact that this went out to something like 450 newspapers through the Washington Post Writers Group Syndicate was, I thought, really amazing. And I thought it was also interesting that within a few months he was no longer in the CFR. So I don't know if he had a break with them on that matter. But once again, I think it's interesting. You do make a good point about how that there are people in the CFR who take alarm over some of the things that are discussed there in terms of plans and proposals that end up being enshrined in public policy. And there are people who've been term members of the CFR, such as Doug Bandow of the Cato Institute, who were in there for 5 years and didn't fit very well. What Doug Bandow told me when I asked him about this, because he's a Christian and he's a libertarian, he's somebody who believes in the Constitution, how did you end up at the CFR? He said, I was invited to join and somebody sponsored me and they brought me in as a term member. And they'll bring on a certain number of people of his persuasion, Doug Bando told me, in order to give the CFR some protective coloration, you know, for the sake of superficial variety. They'll let him some libertarians and some genuine small government conservative types and some people who were authentic anti-communists and things of that variety. I think George Will probably was brought in for that matter and for that purpose and cultivated as somebody who'd fit that role. When you talk here on the other issue about concentration camps, the possibility of detention, putative or preemptive detention of American citizens in the event of wide-scale social turmoil, there are a couple of trends that I think are really interesting and ominous. In Weimar Germany, as in Soviet Russia, after the overthrow of the Tsar in that country, you had these huge economic dislocations. Part of it was brought on by the war. Part of it was brought on in the case of Nazi Germany, or forgive me, post-Wilhelmine Germany, by the reparations that were imposed on Germany, but a large part of it had to do with socialist manipulation of the economy and the destruction of the currency. The dollar is in free fall right now. I don't know if many people are paying that careful attention to what's going on now that the Dow has crested 14,000. Badly inflated, horribly overvalued Dow Jones has crested 14,000. At the same time, we're seeing across the country the escalating, cascading collapse of these regional housing bubbles and mortgage refinancing bubbles. The mortgage refinancing really is what kept our economy, our consumer economy, afloat. Just a few days ago, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a fellow by the name of Alfonso Johnson, was in Beijing to beg the Central Bank of China to start buying mortgage-backed securities in the United States in order to keep the mortgage-backed securities, in order to keep the mortgage and refinancing industry solvent. Nobody wants to buy these securities because they're worthless on account of the fact that most of them are securitized mortgage loans that were made to marginal or unqualified borrowers, what you call the, I'm trying to remember the exact term here, but a lot of these were loans that were made to people who obviously didn't qualify, and so the securities that are the debt instruments that are backed by these mortgage loans are not being bought by anybody. And so the head of the Housing and Urban Development Department was in China to beg the Chinese to help bail out our mortgage sector.
Of course, the term probably would be subprime.
Subprime. Oh, right. That's the one I was grasping for unsuccessfully. Exactly.
They create all these fancy terms that we're supposed to remember them. And then, of course, they create another fancy term. But basically what they've done is they've created all these bonds out there that, of course, valued AAA bonds, valued at 100 cents on the dollar, and hedge funds and pension funds and all sorts of people have funded, bought them, and then when they go around to selling them, they find they're worth 30 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are going to be a lot of hedge funds, a lot of pension funds, and a lot of banks that are going to be looking at simply collapsing. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, William, what did the Chinese do? I bet the Chinese were just anxious to buy all these worthless bonds.
Oh, I'm sure they were chuckling in the chow mein here because nobody wants to buy these securities. You made reference to the fact that the subprime mortgage loans, which, of course, is the term I couldn't remember. It's a term of art that is recently into the vocabulary along with things like reverse amortization and negative amortization mortgages. All of these are pornographically bizarre types of mortgage loans that have been made to people who don't qualify in order to pump up the housing sector and to keep that inflated as a way of driving home prices up so that on the manufactured equity of a home, people can go out and take out a loan and keep the consumer economy afloat. The Federal Reserve is behind this whole process. It's something that everybody knows is going on. Nobody wants to confront squarely. And so you see the subprime sector start to collapse. The HUD secretary goes to Beijing and begs their central bank and also some of their commercial banks, which are, of course, run by the same people that run that government. They're commercial only in a technical sense, but begs them to start buying these mortgage securities. Now, the type of foreign exchange reserves that Beijing has, because they become the factory floor for the world, they are so vast they could buy up the entire Dow Jones if they wanted to. What's happening right now is that Alphonse Jackson, the HUD secretary, asked Beijing specifically to invest in securities which are offered by Ginnie Mae, which, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is a government-sponsored enterprise that is involved in issuing mortgage loans, which is a screamingly unconstitutional thing to do. There's nothing in the Constitution that in any sense could be contorted into saying that the federal government has the authority to issue mortgage loans. These are all, of course, developments of the New Deal and the Great Society and so forth. And what he was telling the people in Beijing is that Ginnie Mae's loans are better than those of Fannie and Freddie because the Ginnie Mae loans are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, whereas Fannie and Freddie are not, although most people think they are, which, of course, is laughable. What that means is that if those loans go bad, in order to cover them, the taxpayer would be put on the hook. The Congress, of course, would write the legislation and pass the appropriations measure to cover these bad loans, and then go to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve would take out his magic checkbook and then exnilate enough so-called money in order to cover that particular bit of deficit spending. It's all quite ludicrous. The Chinese are many things, but stupid is not on that list. They know what's going on right now. However, I do think that it's in their strategic interest to look into the possibility of becoming, if you will, the landlord of last resort for the American housing industry. Now, how horrifying is that prospect? The Chinese are already investing in all kinds of infrastructure in this country, along with other foreign entities from countries like Australia and Spain and Mexico and so forth, buying up municipal infrastructure and state infrastructure from cash-strapped municipal and state governments that don't have the luxury of being able to inflate the currency in order to cover their indebtedness. And now you're talking about the Chinese buying into our mortgage sector, which is why a couple of days ago I published an essay entitled Your Next Landlord Will Speak Chinese. I think that's a very realistic possibility. But behind all this, of course, is the unfolding economic disaster that we're seeing right now, where the dollar is hitting rock bottom and starting to dig. That's the same type of trend line you saw in places like Weimar Germany and early Soviet Russia, where you had hyperinflation as a way of wiping out the middle class. And then the other thing that I find really interesting, and this might seem to be a completely incompatible threat vector here, but you take a look at the attitude on the part of official conservatives right now, and you're talking about beltway-oriented, Republican-aligned conservatives. Now, you're not talking about heartland...
Hold that thought. We'll be right here with him. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about the financial problems that we're facing as a nation, pointing out that the Secretary of Housing was over in Beijing, pleading with the communists to actually begin investing in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans, housing loans, subprime loans, which, of course, are doomed to lose probably two-thirds to three-quarters of the value within the next year or so. So, you know, then, of course, William was saying he has actually written an essay recently that suggested your next landlord may well speak Chinese and points out that the Chinese are over here buying up as much of the infrastructure as they can get because they don't want to lose the value of all those dollars they've got, and they would just as soon invest them right here in the United States. So pick up the story there, William.
One really interesting point about this that I want to make before moving back to the subject of some of the things that are going on culturally in this Weimar moment that we're approaching here in the United States. As of June of last year, Beijing held about $107.5 billion in U.S. mortgage securities. I wasn't aware of that until just a few days ago. And I would assume that number has grown appreciably in the year that has elapsed since the most recent figures were made, or rather, the year that's elapsed since that time. The most recent figures hold that Beijing is in possession of $107.5 billion of mortgage securities, making them, of course, the largest foreign holder of mortgage securities in the American economy. I wasn't aware of that, and I think that fact's very interesting. Now, that's just a very, very small percentage of the mortgage loans which are outstanding, which is something like $11 trillion. But still, it doesn't take a whole lot to leverage the mortgage industry if somebody is willing to come in and buy intelligently and strategically. And the Chinese, as I've said before, may be evil, but they are also cunning, and they think strategically, which is something we do not do. They could really do some damage here in terms of becoming the landlord of last resort for our increasingly troubled housing industry, mortgage industry. Now, the other thing that I think is important, apart from the impending economic collapse of our country, is the attitudes that are coalescing among the official conservative movement, if you will. Now, the official conservative movement has long been defined by William F. Buckley in National Review. William F. Buckley, way back in the 1950s, was talking about how it would be necessary, in the interest of winning what was called the Cold War with the Soviet Union, to put up with what he called a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. In other words, his starting negotiating position was to say, okay, we'll put up with totalitarianism in order to defeat totalitarianism, which had, of course, very little to offer for people like Frank Shadorov and Robert Welch and Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard and other heretics of that sort who were actually concerned with freedom. And so the Buckleyite conservatism that National Review represents is the conservatism of the state. It's more important that we defeat the state's designated enemies than that we protect the individual rights of Americans against the encroachments from the state. There was a really interesting profile published in the British press a couple of weeks ago by a person named Johan Hari, who went on the National Review cruise a few months ago. And it's just an amazing snapshot of the mindset of the type of people who cluster around official conservatism. Johan Hari recalls the following, just a few of the snapshots here. I lie on the beach with Hillary Ann, a chatty 35-year-old Californian designer. As she explains the perils of Republican dating, my mind drifts, watching the gentle tide. When I hear her say, of course, we need to execute some of these people, I wake up. Who do we need to execute? She runs her fingers through the sand lazily. A few of these prominent liberals who are trying to demoralize the country, she says. Just take a couple of these anti-war people off to the gas chamber for treason to show if you try to bring down America at a time of war, that's what you'll get. She squints at the sun and smiles. Then things will change. This is a 35-year-old woman. This is not somebody who is 60, 70, 80 years old and has become hardened and embittered as the result of a disappointing life. This is somebody with their life pretty much in front of her who is a young conservative activist of means who believes that basically the way we should deal with dissent is to send people to the gas chambers. Now, that very much has a certain odor of Weimar about it. And that was not by any means an eccentric or anomalous incident on this National Review cruise. That was pretty much representative of the sentiments that this reporter from Great Britain experienced.
And I really rather think it's rather frightening of the attitude which so many conservatives are taking today. You know, the president is my president, right or wrong, he represents America. Certainly if we were to pull out of Iraq, of course, why, then the terrorists would come over here and attack us. So that's why we have to attack them. Far better to fight the terrorists on the streets of Baghdad than on the streets of New York. And all of this, of course, is rhetoric with no basis in reality. If the terrorists wanted to attack us, they would have done it a long time ago. And maybe most of what we believe just isn't true. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly our guest is William Gregg. Go right ahead, William.
You know, one of the things about our current situation that really pains me is the spectacle of politicians and commentators and activists of a leftist persuasion being right about very important issues. It really sometimes pains me to find myself in agreement with certain people for whom I have very little respect. One such person would be Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've never been able to countenance Patrick Leahy until very recently, when suddenly he started to say things that made sense. For instance, he opposed the Military Commissions Act. He opposed the changes to the Insurrection Act that would allow the president to take control of the National Guard. And just last week, during a hearing into the questions surrounding the dismissal of a number of U.S. Attorneys by the Justice Department, Patrick Leahy said something that was downright profound. He was having a colloquy with Sarah Taylor, who's the former White House political director, a woman I think probably in her early or mid-30s. And what Sarah Taylor said by way of responding to one of the questions from Senator Leahy was the following, and I quote, "I took an oath to the president, and I take that oath very seriously." Now, Patrick Leahy couldn't let that rest. He said, "Wait a second. You took an oath to the president? Didn't you take an oath to the United States Constitution?" And Sarah Taylor, realizing that she had said something inadvertently that was very revealing, said, "Well, no, of course I took an oath to the Constitution." And what Patrick Leahy said, "Well, did you take a second oath to President Bush? I mean, how many oaths did you take?" "Well, no, I just took the one oath, and took the one oath to the Constitution." Now, what Sarah Taylor was revealing here is a candid example of the attitude called Führer Principle, or the leader principle, where you owe your loyalty to the individual rather than to the law. Now, in the republic that we were given by our founding fathers, the law is king. That's something Thomas Paine pointed out in Common Sense. In America, the law is king. You know, we are all beholden to the law, which of course means ultimately God's law, and those positivist or man-made laws that resonate with eternal principles, meaning God's law. You cannot have, as Blackstone pointed out, something that would be a legitimate law that would contravene God's law. So in that sense, our republic is rooted in biblical principles, and we are all subject to that same law, whether we're people who are in the government exercising delegated, lent, and conditional powers, and revocable powers, that's a very important part of the equation, or whether we're common citizens. The idea is that we're all ruled by the law. But there is this attitude that has taken root in Republican circles, where you owe your loyalty to the party and to the president who is the head of that party.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William, of course, is expressing his concern over this centralization of power, this almost pure worship which we have among many of our religious leaders who are taken to the White House and are gently stroked by Karl Rove and the White House staff. And, of course, then they may even have a couple of meals there, and they're told that they're part of a select group, that they really must understand why we must stay in Iraq and why we must invade Iran. And, of course, what you must understand is that this has been going on for some time,
mm-hmm.
and they've been taking our religious leaders back to explain why we are going to attack Iran, and the religious leader's job is then to get the public to accept what the religious leaders tell them as if somehow this is, well, it's almost like it's God's will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, William was simply saying that ordinarily he would not be agreeing with Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
Vermont, yes.
But Patrick Leahy has said a couple of things. Certainly he opposed the John Warner and Military Commission Act of October of last year. And recently he was in committee hearings that some woman was actually talking about the oath she had taken to support the president. And he challenged that. He asked her, even when she'd taken an oath to support the president, actually, she was supposedly taking an oath to support the Constitution. Did she take a second oath? Well, you know, William, certainly there are many people who are liberals, and on many things I would disagree with him, but some of them are really very, very concerned about our loss of freedom.
Oh, yeah.
And they support abortion because they honestly believe that the state should not tell a woman what to do with her body. Mm-hmm. You and I would disagree, at least with the act of abortion, but my feeling is it is not up to the federal government to be involved in this at all. This is a state's issue, and at that point, then of course, the state would have certain rights, but the federal government should not be involved. What we need to do is to agree with the liberals where we can agree with them, disagree with them where we would disagree with them, and try to get them to understand our Constitution.
Yeah.
Maybe if they did understand our Constitution and what's happened to the Constitution, why we would solve a lot of the differences between liberals and conservatives, because our enemies are playing liberals against conservatives, Democrats against Republicans, right, left against right, and we don't want to get caught up in their rhetoric. We want to stand on our principles, and who knows, some of those liberals might honestly begin to support what we're doing if we could find the common ground. We will not certainly make any concessions on what we believe in, but agree where we can, because many of them are very concerned about the expansion of the war in the Middle East, as are we, and I think that we need to stand together on those issues. Go ahead.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that one of the most encouraging developments I've seen is the emergence of what has been called the transpartisan movement, where you simply ignore the arbitrary little reservations onto which they want to throw us. I mean, some of us would end up in the Republican reservation, some of us would end up in the Democrat reservation. The idea is that we would have to plight our troth or pledge our loyalty to that party and its leader at the expense of principle, which is what Sarah Taylor, this former White House political director, was exhibiting when she talked about the oath that she had sworn to her president. The thing is, if we get people thinking in terms of the Constitution and understanding the dangers of illegal, lawless power, then I think that once people understand the danger that we confront as Americans, as individual human beings, then things such as our political affiliations and our pet little causes will be put into proper perspective here. What we need to do is we need to throw the government back into its constitutional cage. And the most important thing we do on that front, of course, is to get it out of the business of perpetual warfare. You cannot have a free society that is perpetually at war. That's something that is as old as, that understanding is as old at least as Plato's Republic. You can go back and look at ancient Sparta, which was always either at war, preparing for war, and it was what we now call a fascist dictatorship. James Madison pointed out that no country could remain free in the midst of perpetual warfare, and that all of these military establishments created supposedly to protect people from foreign danger actually created tyranny at home, which is why when I was living in Appleton about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, my family, my wife Corinne and I and our children, would go to anti-war rallies, and we would astonish people when they'd ask us about our background. I'd say, well, we're anti-war right-wingers, and they'd say, what, you mean you're like people who became disillusioned with George W. Bush? Said, oh, good grief, we would never have voted for George Bush. Are you kidding? No, we're real right-wingers. You know, we believe in the Constitution and national independence and things of this sort. And I remember on a couple of occasions talking with people who would be considered, I think, if you followed conventional categories, they'd be considered antithetical to us in terms of their partisan affiliations. But as we sat down and talked about the things that concerned us the most, we agreed about just about everything. And even on things that were highly contentious social issues, such as abortion or such as the homosexual so-called marriage, we found that we could at least discuss those issues in ways where we understood each other. When you're talking about the principles of federalism as they apply to issues of this sort, or whether the government has the right to redefine an institution that existed before the government, and I'm talking here about marriage specifically, or at least people would understand that. We're not talking about how much we hate people who follow a homosexual lifestyle. We're talking about the concern about the government using its power to redefine that institution in order to satisfy a political pressure group. And once you understand it from that perspective, I think that there's a surprising possibility of genuine common ground. And the person who's demonstrated this brilliantly is Ron Paul, by making freedom the central focus and all-permeating theme of his campaign, his candidacy, he has managed to attract the interest of people from all across every demographic spectrum you could imagine, from staid people in their 70s and 80s who remember Goldwater, to punk rockers and skateboarders who love the idea of limiting government to what it should be doing. They all respond positively to the message of freedom. So that's very encouraging, and I hope that this particular movement, this new freedom movement, will find traction and start really doing some damage to the power elite before the things we've been talking about in the previous segments of this program come into fruition. I would like to think that sometime before they actually start putting people in detention camps, or like this National Review acolyte would have it, sending dissenters to the gas chambers, I'd hope that the freedom movement will find its voice and find its footing and actually cause some very positive changes, because things are really getting scary right now.
Well, they are, but certainly the one thing that sustains me is the realization that there is a spiritual force that energizes the other side, but then there's a spiritual force that energizes our side, if we will come to rely upon it. That doesn't mean we should not be involved. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be speaking out. That doesn't mean that we should not be involved in this truly a great battle of ideas for the survival of civilization, but to realize that we will never be able to win this completely on our own. Mm. We're going to have to rely upon the Lord.
Yes, that much is certain. You know, the really interesting thing you mentioned earlier, Dr. Stan, about the way that the church has been turned into another constituency of the state is something that I have found very disturbing and disheartening. My wife and I have found it very difficult to find a congregation that is theologically conservative without being politically Republican. And we went, I hate to put it this way because it sounds whimsical and superficial, but we had to go church shopping because at congregation after congregation we'd hear people talking about George W. Bush as if he were an adjunct member of the Trinity. And that's because a lot of these people who are the head of these evangelical or what are now called Christian right denominations have been brought into this sacred synod of palace prophets who are wined and dined by the likes of Karl Rove, and they're there as surrogates or proxies or vicars for their entire flock. And so that does trickle down. And when they are corrupted by power, that does trickle down, and it has an impact on local congregations. I'm happy to say the church we're attending here in Payette, Idaho, the Bible Baptist, is very good. The pastor is an ex-Marine, and he is very skeptical of what's been going on with the Bush administration and its wars and so forth. And although many of the people who attend the church are standard-issue Republicans, they're at least willing to listen to us. It's not the case in a number of places that we've attended where it was just considered to be something of approaching high and horrible heresy to suggest that George W. Bush was somebody other than this divine gift that had been bequeathed on our nation at a time of historic crisis. I remember on more than a few occasions, for instance, just before he went to war in March of 2003, sitting through a horrible sermon about our duty to support the president and to fight the wars that our government ordains without cavil or question. And it was all I could do to keep from getting up and leaving. And I knew when we were turning to the book of Ecclesiastes, we're in for trouble. Let us turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. I turned to Corinne and said, let's go. I know where this is going.
Well, you know, of course, yours is not a lone quest. We get calls so often here. And as you know, we have listeners all across the country. And people will call, you know, well, I'm from Ohio. Do you know any good churches here in Ohio? It's a universal plea on the part of conservatives to find a church that will preach the gospel without, of course, bringing in these ancillary things of really, of course, the idea that God is a Republican.
Yeah, let's preach Christ Jesus and Him crucified and teach redemption through God's grace instead of talking about the need, the perceived need, to build up the power of the war machine and to go out and smite the people who've been designated enemies by our government. You know, I want to hear the former. I want to celebrate the redemption offered through the cross, you know, rather than talking about redeeming the world through bombs, you know. But it's the same kind of thing that you saw in the years leading up to World War One. There's a fascinating book called The War for Righteousness, which was published 4 or 5 years ago, that talked about how what is now the Christian right message of the redemptive power of warfare was something that was propagated in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as part of the so-called social gospel, which was theologically liberal, ahistorical, anti-biblical in some respects, funded by the Rockefellers for the purpose of building up the power of the state. This whole progressive movement that brought about the income tax and the Federal Reserve, that brought about our entry into World War I and conscription and wartime communism. The United States was a communist country under the reign of Woodrow Wilson, Colonel House, and Bernard Baruch during World War I. That was all something that was very much promoted by mainline churches. And now you have basically the same message resonating from the pews of these churches that are aligned with the Republican Party right now, which shows you just how dreadfully wrong it is to refer to the Republican Party as in any way conservative. What you've got here is the skin of conservatism that is stuffed with the substance of socialism, hardcore militarist socialism. And that's something that's been around for decades, and I wasn't aware of this once again until I'd read that book a number of years ago, but it's impossible to miss that now.
Well, yeah, it was very interesting on one of the recent debates where certainly Congressman Ron Paul was there, and he was asked by, of course, it was one of these debates where they don't ask everybody the same question.
No.
They try to trap you, and of course they were all waiting for Ron Paul. And they asked him the question, I mean, what is the, so do you think, one of the major philosophical point, you know, that you would disagree with the, I think it was the Republican Party, words to that effect. And everybody thought he would bring out something about homosexuality or abortion or mm-hmm. morality. And without hesitation, he said, it is this concept of a just war, that we have actually, somehow we can justify this concept of what's going on by saying this is a just war. And they didn't know what to say. I mean, because of course everybody else, all the other Republicans, are backing this war. It's a just war.
Well, yeah, he was responding specifically to the fact that all the front runners and some hangers-on like Duncan Hunter, who should know better, were endorsing the use of preemptive nuclear strikes against Iran. I was listening to that debate on, or the so-called debate, on the radio, en route to going to a friend's house to watch the rest of it on television, and it was just astonishing to me the alacrity with which people like Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani and two or three others said, yes, we would not take that option off the table. We would use tactical nuclear weapons if necessary in order to take out Iran's nuclear capability. And I love the fact that at near the end of that debate, it was Ron Paul, as you said, who stood up when asked what the most important moral issue confronting America was today. He said, is this issue of preemptive war? You know, we're talking now about the idea of nuking a country that has never threatened us. He said, and in remarks that he'd offered in the House, Ron Paul has pointed out at some length that he apparently has been reading a different Bible than the one that had been issued to the other leaders of the Republican Party, because in his Bible there's just simply no colorable text that you can find that would justify the use of a preemptive war. You know, and the Christian just war teaching, which some people actually consider to be a compromise of militarism, and that's a position for which I have some sympathy, but the Christian just war teaching does not permit preemptive war. It makes war the last resort. It has to be fought proportionally, meaning that you have to be able to justify it as a lesser evil than the evil you're trying to turn back. And you have to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. And it has to be declared by the proper authority. And the war in Iraq meets none of those criteria. And a war against Iran would meet none of those criteria as well. And it was just amazing to me that somebody had the temerity and the character that Ron Paul displayed in standing up and saying this is completely contrary to the finest and most important teachings of our Christian tradition, what we're talking about in terms of a preemptive nuclear attack on Iran. That one gesture, I think, probably did more to elevate Ron Paul's stature in the eyes of skeptics than anything else he's done, because there was simply no political advantage to be had by doing that. He was doing it out of principle.
And, of course, I really think the big problem we have is that most people have never studied the histories of the wars in the last century.
Yeah.
And if they did study the history of those wars, they'll find that every one of them was unnecessary, every one of them was rigged, certainly we got into the Spanish-American War under false pretenses. We got into the First World War under false pretenses. We got into the Second World War under false pretenses. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident. And, of course, there was no justification for going to a war with Afghanistan, which we'd been financing right up until the very day that Osama bin Laden had actually, at least we're told, had pulled off this surprise attack on America. Why would we be funding Afghanistan as the largest source of humanitarian aid for the country that was giving sanctuary to the wicked Osama bin Laden, who already was wanted for bombing our embassies in both Kenya and Tanzania? Why would we have been doing that? Is it possible that everything we've been told is not true? If Osama bin Laden was the enemy, why didn't we follow him into Pakistan and capture him and end this whole war on terrorism at that time? Well, William, let's go ahead and get your telephone number out there and certainly your website so people know how they can get your information.
The easiest way to see what I produce is to go to The Right Source Online, which is at www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, rightsourceonline.com. It's one word, not The Right Source, but only rightsourceonline.com. That will take you to my blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. I usually update it between 4 and 6 times a week, and those are fully realized and footnoted essays. It's not just random ponderings of the sort that you might find in some other blogs. It's actually a daily or nearly a daily annotated essay. And also there's the e-zine Pro Libertate. It's something that comes out with austere infrequency right now because of certain developments that are beyond my control to deal with right now. But it's a monthly or bi-monthly e-magazine, roughly the same format. If you go to Right Source Online, you'll also find the news section and opinion section where we regularly keep you up to date with some of the most important things that are going on in the world. It's a big world full of very ominous developments, and somebody has to be keeping track of what's going on, and so we're sort of like fire spotters. We're sitting at the top of the lookout tower trying to figure out what's coming, and not a whole lot of it's good right now, I'm afraid to tell you.
Well, I really appreciate what you do with him and certainly your willingness to share your ideas with our listeners. I'm very, very concerned that within a matter of a few weeks to a few months, we're going to be at war with Iran.
Oh, boy.
And certainly our leaders will tell you it's only going to be a 6-day war, and I hope and pray that, first of all, that we don't go to war, and that if we do go to war, it'll be a 6-day war, but there is no way, once you've started a war, to know how it's going to end. And I think that every one of you out there in the listening audience ought to be praying that I am absolutely wrong, that we're not going to war, and if we do go to war, it'll be 6 days, but then pray for the people, not only our own men who will be involved, but pray for the Iranian people too, because they're God's people, every one of them made in the image and likeness of God, and we're certainly not going to win them to our side and into the folds of brotherhood of Christianity by bombing them into oblivion. Well, I want to thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us, and I encourage people to go to your website to get your information. You're always a fascinating and challenging guest.
Thank you so much.
Good night. God bless.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and it is always a pleasure to have William Grigg as a guest here. And listen to what he has to say. He's got a great deal of knowledge and a great deal of wisdom. You can certainly go up on the Internet and certainly Google it, William Grigg, and go to his blog site, read the material he has, and if you are in a position to support him, he and his family certainly can use all the support they can get at the present time. He's a dedicated patriot, dedicated to preserving America. Well, this is the time when, of course, I have to remind all of our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, And we do depend upon those of you out there in the listening audience to help us. As we reach out 5 hours every single day, 5 days a week, and then on a weekend to about 30 stations, to try to get people to understand where we're headed. And, of course, we're headed in towards disastrous programs that could lead not only to the financial bankruptcy of our nation, but to the moral bankruptcy of our nation and the loss of all freedom. Your job is to get people to understand what's going on, to get them to listen to our programs, and of course, to check out the sources of information which we and our guests make available, and then to help people understand the spiritual forces which are energizing the men who are leading our country towards destruction. Understand that there is no such thing as a just war. Any just war would be a matter of defending our homeland, and we have not fought to defend our homeland at any time in over 100 years. Every one of these wars has been staged. If you've not yet heard my talk, Iraq, the Untold Story, which covers the wars starting in 1898, the Philippine-American War, which most people have never heard of, certainly next war, which was the Boer War, which involved Great Britain, but of course it involved the secret society which controls America today. You want to get my talk, Iraq, the Untold Story, and you want to get the syllabus that goes along with that. We have, of course, an even more updated version of that, the talk we gave in Colorado, which we'll have available here in the near future. But I rather like my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story. The other is called War, the Untold Story. You'll certainly want to get my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness and of the Forbidden Secret and get the syllabus that goes with that, because they will take you into the spiritual forces which energize this whole incredible movement and are moving America, Western civilization, towards the destruction. That's Brotherhood of Darkness and the Forbidden Secret. You'll want to get Sydney Iron 4 tapes or 4 CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret. You'll want to get Johanna Michelson's book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, and the 4 tape set that contains her interviews called, and that's Johanna Michelson, it's called The Supernatural. You want to get the videos, I should say DVDs, by Chris Pinto, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and the sequel to it, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And then, of course, Chris Pinto gave a talk at the at Radio Liberty Conference, and it's called The Atlantis Connection. And you may wonder what Atlantis has to do with anything in America, but until you begin to understand that for thousands of years, the secret societies have always believed in the rebirth of lost Atlantis that would lead the world to the New World Order, the New World Religion, and, of course, the New World Leader. And America has been elected to that position, which is why we are fighting in Afghanistan, why we are fighting in Iraq, and why we're going to war with Iran. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.